Open the House Committee on Consumer Protection. And January 17th, 2007. Today we're, and I apologize for opening a little late. Our session ran a little late, so I was giving some of our members a little time to replenish their vital signs. And today we have three bills we'll be having a public hearing on, and I'd like to just jump right into that. And so I would like to open a public hearing on House Bill 2220. And Committee Administrator Steve, would you like to give us a summary of the bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2220 revises existing law regarding the licensing of pawnbrokers. It allows the Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services to establish the frequency of license examinations, requires certain things of pawnbrokers as far as storing records, and eliminates the requirement that persons reside in Oregon in order to receive a pawnbroker license. And that's it for 2220.
So we have signed up to speak from the Department of Consumer and Business and Business and Services, David Tapman.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. That's a division within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Last Friday, you received a comprehensive overview of both the department and the division by the director of the department, Corey Streisinger. One of the bills that we've decided to promote is to modernize or at least update some of the provisions of the Pawnbroker Act. Our division is responsible for 14 different financial services industries within the state of Oregon. Essentially, we cover almost any financial services with the exception of insurance. The ones that come to mind most readily are banking, credit unions, mortgage lending, the securities, the regulation of sales of securities, and consumer finance, including short-term lenders, payday, and title lenders, and pawnbroking. The regulation of pawnbrokers, while not our largest program, is certainly an important part of our consumer protection program. And we have 43 pawnbrokers in the state of Oregon licensed with us at this time. The history of pawnbroking shows that this is a long-standing practice for loaning money for people who need money on a short-term basis. And the laws in Oregon go back to 1913 and have been addressed periodically by the legislature, but they've not been updated to reflect the digital or electronic age. And so what we are asking the committee and ultimately the legislature to consider would be modernizing the act to reflect that in this day and age, rather than keep records by pen and ink, as this law currently requires, they can be retained either electronically or digitally. That serves several purposes. One, it streamlines the process for the pawnbroker. It ensures a way of backing up their records and protecting their records. And most importantly, the police are able to use those records and compare lists of stolen property digitally. In fact, in many cities, they're required to retain their records digitally, and so our laws are inconsistent with some of the city codes. So we think it's appropriate to update that. You may recall last summer there was an article about a stolen laptop from the Attorney General's office, and the laptop was ultimately recovered in the Portland area at a second-hand store, and the police were able to find it because they were tracing identification numbers, ID numbers, against a list of stolen property they had. And that's exactly what we want this act to be able to do. So that's one of the changes we're asking for. Borrowers can be in a vulnerable stage when they are in need of money. The Act provides a number of safeguards, particularly provisions for making sure that a borrower doesn't default and the pledged item is not sold or taken away from the ability for the borrower to recover that item very readily. And we want to maintain all those safeguards. What we are asking is the change in the record retention, also a change in terms of the application process. The application process currently has to be posted for 30 days before a license can be issued. Originally, that served time to allow the administrator to go in and get information from neighbors, friends, and colleagues. In this day and age, we can do that pretty readily by doing an internet search and asking for background information. In fact, we get references, and we check those references before issuing a license. But we think the 30-day rule is an outdated or antiquated concept that really just trips up people or delays them from being able to get a license. The only other thing I'd like to add is that we are asking to change the examination process. We have 43 licensees, and currently we are charged with examining them on an annual basis. Every other year we do that in person, and then in the contrasting year we do that by a mail-in where they send us information per our request, and we review that. Almost all of our licensees, our pawnbrokers, are in good standing. They maintain their records well. We find very few problems. We get very few complaints. We think that it is not necessary to have an annual examination. We want the ability to go in and conduct an examination, obviously, for cause, and that already exists. But we'd like to have the ability to determine when to do examinations as a discretionary matter, and then allow us to make the determination. Obviously, if the company's in bad shape or we're having problems with them, we will go in and conduct an exam. If our exam shows there are more problems, we will put them on a fast track of checking back in 6 months or a year. But if they're in good standing, we don't see the need to necessarily have an exam every year. And with that, I'll conclude and ask if there are any questions.
Questions from the committee?
Well, I have one. Do you? You've indicated to me there might be changes coming to this this particular bill, or anybody interested in amendments to this bill?
And Mr. Chair, I'm not aware of any amendments to this bill. We have several from our division that do have amendments, but I think this is one that I understand is, as it was drafted, is okay.
Okay. Thank you very much. Next, we have Paul Romaine on the docket from the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I represent the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. We are in full support of House Bill 2220 as written. The division was great to work with over the summer. My understanding is a few of the pawnbrokers actually met with them, went over some of the practical concerns. They were addressed. It is a little bit ridiculous to have the requirement to keep records in pen and in ink now. We operate with, most of our folks have electronic systems anyway, so it's an easy conversion. We would support the bill and hope that you would pass it quickly and get it through the system. Thank you.
Any questions? It's just way too simple.
That's all my bills this year.
Thank you very much. Is there anybody else that would wish to testify on House Bill 2220? With that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2220 and open a hearing on House Bill 2221. Committee Administrator Steve, will you read us a summary?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2221 establishes and requires licensing for purveyors of discount medical plans. Licenses require providers to have contract with or agreement with service provider or provider network, and prohibits the misleading and deceptive or false statements to consumers in promotion of these plans and also in their documents.
First up to provide testimony, Tim Martinez. Is that correct? Oh, excuse me, Joel Oreo. Excuse me.
Chairman Hovey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joel Oreo. I'm the administrator with the Insurance Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2221, which would establish a licensing program and other consumer protection regulations for medical discount plans. Medical discount plans are currently available in the marketplace, and some of them serve a very legitimate purpose. What they do essentially is offer people discounts to a certain network of providers. So you pay maybe $60 a month or whatever, and then you have these discounts to providers to reduce your expenses. And they do fill a niche in the market for people who either don't have health insurance or have a fairly spare health insurance plan. You'll hear today from somebody who does represent the legitimate medical discount plans in the marketplace, and they share our interest in separating themselves from the illegitimate ones. And unfortunately, there are some illegitimate plans in the marketplace that prey on people who with health care insurance prices where they are today, are always looking for some way to afford health care. And if you look at the back of my testimony, direct you to the two sheets on the back, but if you just look at the first one, you see the kind of advertising that is directed at people desperate for health coverage. Health care for the entire family for $3 per day. If the offer is too good to be true, it's probably too good to be true. And then you see that it suggests that it is more than it is. There's a line at the bottom there, all pre-existing conditions accepted. That sounds like an insurance term. It sounds like it's an insurance coverage of some sort. And then that my favorite is the little box in the middle. This rate is good through Friday only. High-pressure sales tactics. You know, if this deal is really good and if you want it, you got to be here. You got to join up by Friday. This is the illegitimate types of these discount plans that this bill proposes to regulate. What kind of complaints do we see about these plans? We see several listed there on the first page of my testimony. The plans that have been represented as being insurance when they're not insurance. The providers sometimes have not agreed to the discounted fees. I get a call from a hospital that says, what's with these people showing up at my hospital saying that they're supposed to get discounts with us? We've never entered into any agreements, but they've been sold a plan that says that they're going to get those discounts. And then if people, after they find out that the plan isn't what it was advertised to be, they want to cancel their membership, oftentimes can't find anybody to call and any way to do that cancellation. And that's oftentimes big trouble, particularly if they've given a credit card in for monthly, annual monthly deductions from their account. So again, you'll hear today there are legitimate forms of these cards as well, but we're after the ones that are engaged in these kind of problems. What does our regulatory program propose to do? We propose to have a regulatory program that would do, I think, two essential things, and I'll talk about some secondary things that it would do as well. First thing is it would require these discount plans, which are not insurance, so it takes a new program. We don't have regulatory authority over these plans today. But we would propose to have that regulatory authority, and the first thing we would require is that they be licensed with us. That way, if somebody is involved in a sales situation and they want to know, is this one of the legitimate ones that maybe actually could provide a niche product for me or is it not, they could call us and we could see whether they're licensed or not. It's an easy way to separate the legitimate from the illegitimate. So that's a first function. Of course, not everybody knows to call us, but the ones that do, this would serve that purpose. The second, and to my mind maybe even more important, consumer protection here is a 30-day free look period. That gets at this issue of the high-pressured sales tactics, people buying things because the person in front of them is a persuasive seller. They have 30 days to decide that maybe this wasn't what I really wanted to purchase and maybe it isn't what it was cracked up to be. So the 30-day free look period helps to neutralize the high-pressure sales tactics. The bill also does several other things which are listed in the middle of page 2 of my testimony. It prohibits operation of a medical discount plan without a written certain contract with service providers. There has to be a way to ensure that the plan actually has a network that will grant the discounts. Next, it requires licensees to offer customers a toll-free customer assistance phone number, be a way to get a hold of the plan on a dependable basis. Establishes the refund requirements when people do want to take advantage of the free look period. Establishes advertising restrictions and disclosure requirements, as that the ad that I had you look at, there are, one of the issues here is a lot of false advertising, and so the bill gives us authority over that. And it prohibits plan documents and advertising from stating that the state of Oregon reviews or approves medical discount plans. You wouldn't think this is necessary, but we often find once we establish a regulatory program and people start to say, well, the fact that we have been licensed means that the state approves of us, and this is an Oregon state-sponsored activity. Well, of course, it's not. We do a fairly simple licensing process, so that would be prohibited from claiming that from the state of Oregon. And then finally, it authorizes the director, the department, to investigate license applications and violations of the law, and to either refuse to issue licenses where the people can't meet basic standards, or to suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew licenses. There is, I should point out here, a current program similar to this program that applies to prescription drug discount plans. It was passed by the legislature a couple sessions ago, and it gives both local district attorneys and the attorney general the right to go after injunctive relief and damages in certain situations for prescription drug discount plans. We think that the core idea there is a good one, so we keep that idea in this bill, that authority in this bill, and in fact expand that authority so it doesn't apply just to prescription drug discount plans, but applies to any type of medical discount plan. That's the way in which we expand upon the original law. The second thing we do, though, is since we're putting in place now a licensing program with its own set of requirements and our own administrative authority to follow up on those, we delete that authority for the attorney general or the district's attorneys for people who get their licenses. Anybody who stays outside of our system, who's operating outside the legal framework here, they're still subject to those actions, the injunctive relief and the damages. But if somebody comes within our regulatory program, then we make our regulatory program the primary enforcement agent. The one qualification we have there is we keep the right in the bill to go back to the Attorney General and ask for the Attorney General's assistance with a particular enforcement action. So that's what's in the bill. We will have amendments to the bill. The representative from the National Association that represents the discount industry will testify in a few minutes, Alan Ehrenbaum, and my staff have been working diligently today on some technical amendments, and I think that we'll be ready with those amendments within a few days, and so we will submit those to the committee. The only amendments that are of consequence to the printed bill, significant amendments, are the two that are listed on the third page of my testimony, and that is when a licensee funds a consumer's payment during the free look period, the licensee may retain a one-time processing fee not to exceed an amount set by rule. There's a national model law that we're working off here from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and that law would give allow the plan to keep a $30 administrative fee. So presumably that's what we do by rule, but we thought it better to have a rule for that than to put a number like that in the statute and then have to change the statute, you know, 6 years from now or something. The second thing that the bill does, and this also comes out of the national model, is toughens up the regulation of advertising. So the licensee, the discount plan itself, has to approve any advertising, sales, or other marketing materials used by any of the licensee's marketers, and upon our request, must submit all those materials to us. And you can imagine there's quite a volume here, so we generally don't want them to submit everything, but if we see a problem, we would want to be able to go and collect whatever information we need on their advertising. It's a quick summary of the program. It would take effect on January 1st, 2008. I respectfully request the committee's support for House Bill 2221, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the committee. Representative Galizio.
Yes, Mr. Arroyo. Since it's the beginning of the session, I actually had time. Last night I was searching for what different states were doing, and I noticed that Florida, where I think Corey Streisinger said, is a, you know, sort of an area where obviously there's a big market, a large market, so this is already happening. And so what I noticed that what they do there is they, these, in the marketing and the advertising, they can't use the word insurance, or they can't use the word copayment, or they can't use the word guaranteed issue, you know, sort of words that would imply insurance. So I'm just wondering, and I'm not suggesting that that's a better way to go, I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about why the approach that I'm seeing in Section 9 in terms of the marketing is preferable.
Okay, Mr. Chair, Representative Glisdale, very good question and good research, because you're absolutely right that Florida is kind of a gold standard in regulation of market discount plans. I chair the relevant committee at the NAIC, and I worked very closely with Richard Bledo from that department, put together the NAIC model, and we had a lot of discussion of those points. The reason why Florida has the much more aggressive regulation is because they've seen a lot of abuse in this area, specific kinds of abuse, and they've had a number of enforcement actions. We have a slightly more flexible regulatory program here and didn't get into quite as much detail because we have not seen the same level of problem here. So we don't have as restrictive a model as the Florida model. If we were to see problems, we have the authority under the bill to ramp up our authority. I wouldn't have a big problem with calling out some of the specific terms that you called out not to be used in the advertising. It's always a challenge as to how prescriptive you want to be with your regulatory framework. And on this one, we're somewhere in the middle based on where we see what the level of problem is.
Questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. I have a question. This appears to create a private right of action. Do you anticipate that consumers will also bring claims under the Unlawful Trade Practices Act? Is there a reason why there's a separate private right of action under this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, I don't think there is a private right of action. There's a right of action for the Attorney General and the District Attorney. I could be wrong, but if you tell me where you're reading.
Oh, I was just looking at on page 6 and 7.
I think those actions refer to actions by either the Attorney General or a district attorney. But I'm looking at myself.
So there's no consumer private right of action then for violation of this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, that's correct.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you, Mr. Arroyo.
Thank you.
Next up to testify, Alan Ehrenbaum.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alan Ehrenbaum. I'm an attorney in the Los Angeles office of Mayor Brown, Rowe, and Maughan. I'm pleased to be before you today on behalf of the Consumer Health Alliance, the National Trade Association of Discount Healthcare Companies. I wanted to take a few minutes to talk with you about the discount healthcare industry, about the Consumer Health Alliance, and our views regarding how to ensure that House Bill 2221 protects consumers and gives Oregonians the ability to enjoy continued access to affordable health care services and products. We also have submitted more comprehensive written testimony for the record. Discount healthcare programs are non-insurance programs which offer consumers access to healthcare products and services at discounted rates. The programs are offered not just by discount companies directly to the public, but by insurance companies to subscribers, banks to customers, and nonprofit organizations to members. The simplicity and value of the programs are enjoyed by millions of people in every state in the country. Our member companies have about 300,000 participants in Oregon today. Discount programs began operating about 15 to 20 years ago, primarily to offer, at discounted rates, access to health care services not typically covered by insurance. These services typically included dental, pharmacy, vision, chiropractic, and hearing. Legitimate discount healthcare companies have always made clear that the access they provide to these discounts is not insurance. In recent years, the skyrocketing cost of healthcare has made traditional health insurance increasingly unaffordable. The instability in the market has created an opportunity for some bad actors to exploit unwitting consumers through discount healthcare schemes that promise a lot and deliver little or nothing. Leading discount healthcare programs became concerned that these bad actors were going to define the industry in the minds of consumers, legislators, and regulators. In order to ensure that this didn't happen and to protect consumers' access to legitimate discount healthcare programs, these companies joined together to form CHA, the Consumer Health Alliance, which is now the National Trade Association of Discount Healthcare Companies. CHA's mission is threefold. First, to educate consumers and regulators and legislators about the consumer benefits of quality discount healthcare programs, and to give consumers the information they need to find a reputable program. Second, to create a code of conduct which establishes benchmarks for well-operated consumer-friendly programs. And third, to work with state legislatures and regulators to develop laws and regulations that provide appropriate consumer information and protection, create tools to shut down fraudulent companies, and allow legitimate companies to continue to provide access to affordable health care without unnecessary burdens. In the last few years alone, CHA has worked with legislatures in about 20 states, and we've also worked closely with the National Association of Insurance Commissioners, specifically with Administrator Ario, who leads the relevant NEIC committee on the development of the NEIC model legislation. In order for any state legislation in this area to be effective, we believe it needs to achieve two primary goals. First, it has to be targeted. The legislation must clearly and specifically address the key discrete problems that have emerged with respect to some discount programs, namely fraudulent or misleading advertising, fly-by-night companies, and inadequate consumer protection. At the same time, it should not unnecessarily hinder the operations of legitimate companies. Second, it needs to be practical. The legislation must recognize that because discount healthcare programs are not insurance, they should not be regulated as insurance. The regulatory responsibilities placed on the insurance division by the legislation should be at a level that the state can reasonably be expected to handle and companies can reasonably be expected to comply with. With these goals in mind, CHA believes that legislation should contain the following five basic components. One, registration or licensing, a way for the state to know who is operating in the state. And just as importantly, a way for the state to give consumers information about which programs are registered or licensed, thereby reducing the number of consumers who enroll in fraudulent programs in the first place. Second, disclosures. Disclosure ensures that consumers understand what their program is and what it is not. The most important disclosure, of course, is that the program is not insurance. In addition, the discount program should disclose that discounts are available only at participating providers and that members are responsible for paying the entire discounted rate at the point of service. Third, operational requirements. Discount programs should be required to operate in a consumer-friendly manner. This means that consumers should be provided with a toll-free number and a website to find participating providers and to get answers to questions about the program. Consumers should be able to cancel their membership within 30 days and get a refund of membership fees. And the discount program should be prohibited from any advertising that's false, misleading, or deceptive, and should approve in writing all advertising of its program used by marketing entities. Fourth, provider agreements. A fundamental element of every discount program is that the providers that are listed in conjunction with the card have to be contracted to participate in the program and to provide the promised discount. Where the contracts are with networks, this is typically the case, the networks must be authorized to contract with discount programs on behalf of the providers in the network. And finally, fifth, remedies. Basic remedies should be available to the state to enforce the discount program registration or licensing. With regard to House Bill 2221, it contains all the elements described above, which CHA supports. We do believe that amendments are necessary to develop a final product that protects both consumers and legitimate discount healthcare programs. Our comments are largely based on our past experience with similar legislation in other states and with the Model Act recently adopted by the NAIC. CHA members operate discount programs on a national basis. As a result, consistency is an important objective with state legislation. CHA has encouraged the division and the department to use appropriate language from the NAIC Model Act wherever possible. In addition, CHA encourages the department and the division to describe the specific requirements applicable to discount programs in the legislation itself wherever possible. We have, Administrator Ario has said, we have had productive discussions with the department and the insurance division in an effort to develop appropriate amendments. We appreciate very much the willingness of the division and of Administrator Ario and others to work with us on language that will help us reach our common goals. We've made a lot of progress and expect to be able to propose amendments to the committee shortly. In conclusion, we look forward to working with the committee, with the department, and with the insurance division to develop legislation which provides strong protections for consumers, creates tools to shut down fraudulent companies, and allows legitimate discount healthcare programs to continue providing access to affordable healthcare services and products to hundreds of thousands of Oregon residents. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ehrenbaum. Any questions from the committee of Mr. Ehrenbaum? Representative Galizio.
I don't know if you could do this, you know, in brief, because my research didn't go this far, but I'm just wondering if you could just describe kind of the business model in terms of profitability. How do folks in your industry make a profit?
Well, the basic business model is that the discount program is the middle person between the consumer who's getting access to the discounted services and the provider who's providing the discounted services. The discount program has contracts with both, and essentially typically what happens is the consumer will pay a monthly fee for a package of healthcare services, typically, you know, dental, vision, prescription drugs, and the like. Maybe it'll be $19.95 a month. And for that, the consumer and generally the consumer's family get a list of providers or access to a list of providers who have been contractually obligated to give a discount off of what they would typically charge somebody who didn't have insurance or was a cash-paying customer. And that is how it works. It's actually quite simple. In terms of the relationship between the consumer and the provider, the discount program has absolutely nothing to do with it. The discount program doesn't care whether the consumer uses the program never or uses it every day. There's no limits in that regard. That usage isn't tracked or restricted in any way by the discount program. The price is set by contract, but the payment arrangements are up to the consumer and the healthcare provider wish to establish.
Any other questions from the committee? Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, I apologize for getting here a little late. I had an emergency and had to take care of that. But so if I missed this in your presentation, I apologize. can you tell me how or if the provider of this policy, it's not an insurance policy, I understand, but how you determine if the providers are actually giving the discount that they say, how do you know what the normal rates are for cash, and what do you do about that?
Mr. Chair and Representative Riley and members of the committee, as I mentioned, most of the providers that are used, because our programs operate nationally, most of the providers are members of national provider networks. Frequently, those provider networks are the same provider networks that insurance companies use. And typically the discount program is just accessing the provider network on the same terms that any other payor is using it. So the only difference is that, let's say a provider network has contracts with its providers, that's dentists, let's say. Let's say the usual and customary fee for a cleaning may be $75, but under the network's contract, the provider's obligated to pay to accept $50 for it. That network may then sign a contract with an insurance company where the insurance company, if somebody goes to the dentist, may pay the provider $50. The discount program has the same contract with the provider network under which the member, when they go to the dentist, pays the dentist $50. So it's typically, it is either, the discounts are either, in the case of dental, for example, it's usually a fixed fee schedule, which is reduced off of typical prices. Or in the case of, for example, prescription drugs or eyeglasses, it's typically a percentage discount off of what the regular price is.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Belizio.
All right, we're doing all right with time and everything?
Oh,
okay, all right. I just want to make sure I understand what I'm reading in your testimony. Are you asking that in Oregon the industry not be regulated by the insurance division?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, no, we're not asking for that at all. We're perfectly happy to be regulated by the insurance division. We just don't want to be regulated as insurance.
Okay.
And we think it's important that because our companies, as I talked about in response to your earlier question, we are not payers, we're not paying providers, we're not carrying the financial risk that insurance companies are. We are more than willing to subject ourselves to the regulation of the state. We just want that regulation to be appropriate to the nature of the programs.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, Mr. Aaron Baum.
Thank you.
For your testimony. Next, I'd like to have Tim Martinez from the Oregon Medical Association.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I apologize for not being in the room when you called me up earlier. I am here today on behalf of the Oregon Medical Association. First of all, I just like to say that this certainly seems like this could be the session where the legislature really focuses in on health policy and health care issues, access issues, certainly women's wellness issues, kids insurance issues. And we applaud both the House and Senate for making that a priority in the 2007 session. This bill is an example of that coming to you from DCBS. I did have the opportunity prior to your meeting today to visit very briefly with Corey Streisinger, who is the head of DCBS, on this bill, and was very pleased to hear from her that this is a work in progress, and she is looking for input as a whole from the various stakeholders that would be utilizing this, including the providers. So we look forward to working with her and with this committee and others as this bill works its way through the process. I would very briefly say that there are four issues that we will be discussing with the insurance division as they work this bill, as you do as well, and that is the reimbursement services, how that is set up for providers in the process with this program, to make sure that reimbursement schedule is disclosed to the provider panels as they go forward, to make sure there is also an appeals process not only for the individuals that use this program, but for the providers that participate in the program. And then, as I say, we do look forward with working with DCBS as this bill evolves over time. So I'd be happy to answer any questions, but again, we are, I think we said we were neutral on the bill, but we do look forward to working with the sponsors.
Any questions from the committee of Mr. Martinez? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to call Joel Aereo back to the witness stand. And if you could restate your name just so we get it on the record that you have something else to say.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record again, Joel Aereo from the Department of Consumer and Business Services. It usually takes me at least several times of testimony before I have to do what I have to do now, which is admit a mistake. And it is in relation to Representative Bonamici's question about a private right of action. I wasn't as familiar with that part of the bill. I did look at it, talked to my staff back there, and in fact, the bill in Section 12 on page 6 does create the private right of action that you
Thank you. I'm
about.
Relieved. I thought maybe I read it wrong.
The right of action, I now reviewed it carefully, is for a person, a municipal or other public corporation, or, at our request, the Attorney General. So the district attorney part was not correct either. It's those entities that can bring an action are a person, a municipal or public corporation, or, again, at our request, the Attorney General. It is not connected with the Unfair Trade Practice Act. It is just a direct private right of action under this law, and it would allow for injunctive relief whenever there is a violation of the key provisions of this law. Any of those entities could bring that private right of action, and they also, if they could prove damages, could collect damages. They're separate remedies, the injunctive relief and the damages. So again, I always have to do this at some point in the legislative session. I'm sorry it was the first time I testified, but I do apologize for the mistake and appreciate the question, and I hope you'll accept my clarification.
Thank you for the clarification.
Thank you very much, and as long as we get it right, I don't care how many corrections you make. So
thank
really,
you.
Really appreciate that. It'll probably save us from a potential amendment.
Thank you.
At this time, I'd like to call Laura Etherton. I hope I said that correctly.
Hi, Chair Holvey, members of the committee. My name is Laura Etherton. I'm the consumer advocate for Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. I'll keep my comments brief, but I wanted to convey OSPIRG's support for these consumer protections in House Bill 2221. As we all know, Oregonians across the state are struggling to find quality, affordable health care. And it's critical that Oregon provide a layer of protection for consumers who are considering medical discount plans. It's critical that those protections do not allow illegitimate plans to conduct business in Oregon, ones that do not actually deliver the discounts that they promise, and that there be strict controls on false or misleading advertising and the terms used to sell these plans. We support this bill's provisions to regulate these plans in Oregon and to provide consumers with improved disclosure about what these plans actually are and that they are not actually insurance, and believe this is a positive move forward for consumer protection. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony today. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to provide testimony on House Bill 2221? Seeing none, I look forward to seeing those amendments if the DCBS and advocates can keep me posted on their views on the amendments as soon as we get them. That would be appreciated. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2221 and open a hearing on House Bill 2202. Committee Administrator Steve Dixon will summarize the bill for us, please.
House Bill 2202 prohibits persons from conducting check cashing businesses without a license from the Department of Consumer and Business Services Director. It limits fees to $5 or 3%, whichever is greater, and applies to government and payroll checks only, and provides the DCBS with investigative enforcement powers and declares an emergency.
Thank you. At this time, I'd like to bring up Department of Consumer and Business Services Director Corey Streisinger and David Tapman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Good afternoon. I'm Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and with me, as you know, is David Tapman, Administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. And I'm pleased to be here this afternoon to testify in support of our bill, House Bill 2202, which is also a high priority for Governor Kulongoski and part of his consumer protection agenda. This bill would cap the fees that can be charged for cashing a government or payroll check. We first became interested in this issue actually as an outgrowth of some discussions with advocates who work on hunger issues and who brought to our attention some of the financial challenges faced by lower-income people in dealing with some of the fundamental issues involving financial services. And one of the issues we became aware of, and you'll see this theme in some of our other bills, which you're going to be hearing later this week, is that often financial services are of particularly high cost for people who are the least able to afford them, for the poor. And with respect to check cashing services in particular, they are often used by people who do not have traditional bank accounts, whether with a bank or credit union. Nationally, about 10% of households do not have bank accounts, and the numbers are even higher for people who are financially challenged. Some statistics show that around 22% of low-income households don't have bank accounts, and nearly half of all households moving from welfare to work don't have traditional bank accounts. And for these households, day-to-day financial transactions can be a challenge. Think about not having a checking account. You may be employed and get a paycheck. You may get a disability check from the government. You may get other forms of public assistance. But you have no bank account into which to deposit that check. And you have no bank account on which to write a check for your rent, for your utilities, for your groceries. Check cashing services are very important for this population. They provide a very needed service. Someone can take their payroll check or their assistance check or their disability check and get it cashed and either purchase a money order or use the cash to pay for their basic needs. But these services can be very expensive. And that is our concern. These check cashing businesses sometimes charge up to 6%, 8%, or in some cases even 10% for cashing a check just to give the customer access to their own funds. And sometimes these are payroll checks. These could be government checks, or these could be personal checks. And the higher percentage fees tend to be associated, of course, with the personal checks, for which the risks are greater. But I want to talk about government and payroll checks in particular today because that's the focus of our proposal. And, you know, as a public body, we care about people having wages that are large enough to support themselves. That's why we have a minimum wage law. We use our tax dollars to provide public assistance to the needy, to provide disability benefits and other types of public benefits that often are paid in the form of a check. So this is our tax dollars at work for those government checks. And it's employers' dollars when they write a paycheck. Yet if 6 or 8% of that check comes off the top just for that consumer to get access to their own funds, then the purposes of those public policies aren't being carried out, and it's that much more difficult for that poor person to make it financially. Government and payroll checks are, as I said, fairly low risk for check cashing businesses. And 32 states and the District of Columbia currently regulate check cashing. Oregon does not. About three-quarters of the states that regulate check cashing limit fees that check cashers can charge for government payroll checks. Some states also limit fees for personal checks. And the majority of those caps for government payroll checks are set at 3% of the face value of the check or $5, whichever is greater. And attached to my written testimony, you'll see some state-by-state comparisons. There are a couple of bar charts, one for government checks, one for payroll checks, that that look like this, that show you what other states charge. And then there is a more narrative of the different regulatory structures state by state. So our proposal is to bring Oregon in line with the mainstream of what other states are doing by imposing limits on the fees for government payroll checks at that range of 3% of the face value or $5, whichever is greater. Caps at those levels don't seem to have hindered the success of this industry. It is a thriving industry, and we've provided you with some data in my written testimony about the size of the industry nationally. And most checks nationally that are cashed in through these services are, in fact, payroll checks. And mostly the rate of return checks, that is, uncollectible checks, is, in fact, very small. We believe that many check cashers already charge fees that are within the range that we're proposing, but for those that do not, this would protect some very vulnerable Oregonians from being charged fees, which we believe are excessive. In order to implement this, we would require licensure of check cashing businesses, and the bill would require would give DCBS the authority to take action regarding violations. It would give us examination authority and rulemaking authority. We do recognize that cashing of personal checks can pose greater risks, and in this bill we are not proposing to limit the fees charged for cashing personal checks. We are also not proposing to interfere with the business decision about when to cash a check. An individual business would be able to require ID, and they would be able to refuse to cash a check that they believe is questionable in terms of its legitimacy. We will be proposing two minor amendments to the bill as drafted. One is to insert the word warrants into the definition of payment instruments issued by governments, because in some cases technically those are called warrants rather than checks. And then we also want to clarify that the fee for application for a license would also constitute the initial license fee for the first period. The bill exempts financial institutions, that is banks and credit unions. It exempts retailers who cash checks as an incidental part of their business, as a convenience, that is cashing a check at the grocery store, as long as they don't charge more than 2% or $2 for that fee. And in fact, most grocery store types of arrangements do not charge for check cashing. In addition, entities that are licensed as money transmitters would not be required to be separately licensed, although they would be subject to the fee caps. I've attached a section-by-section analysis which goes into some of the more technical details of the bill, and Mr. Tapp and I would be happy to respond to any questions.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions from the committee? Streisinger, or would we like to hear from Mr. Tapman first?
I have a quick question. Thank you. I wonder if you could talk about why there is not a proposal to also include personal checks, recognizing that there may need to be a higher fee for personal checks because there is greater risk.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, from our view, the by far the largest issue for this industry and for vulnerable consumers is government and payroll checks. Personal checks cover a wide spectrum, and although there are some states that do impose caps on those fees, the caps do tend to be considerably higher, and the risk is more difficult to predict. So we started with a sort of middle ground proposal that is very consistent with what the majority of other states do, and that addresses what we view as the largest part of the problem. And Mr. Chair, Mr. Tapman's here to answer questions, but I've presented the testimony for the department, so I don't believe he has separate comments to offer, although
he may chime in.
He may chime in.
Representative Riley.
Thank you. Corey, just one quick question. Do you have a spreadsheet of what other states do, including the personal checks?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, yes. One of the attachments that looks like this actually lays out state by state, and that includes the those states that cap charges for personal charges.
I see it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any other questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Galizio.
This is tangentially related. How does DCBS, how would this sort of the enforcement and the implementation take place? In other words, is it generated by complaints? Or do you sort of, do you have the person power to actively, I mean, I'm just curious about that whole element of it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Galizio, there is a fiscal impact to this bill, and we would anticipate adding, I believe, one FTE.
That's correct.
This would work similarly to most of our financial programs, where businesses would be required to apply for and obtain a license from us, and then we would have the ability to do periodic examinations. We have been moving further away, and you heard this in the pawnbroker discussion earlier, further away from a rigid schedule and more toward a risk-based type of examination. So our intent would be to do examinations based on indications of problems and to respond to complaints. And we would have the ability to take enforcement action, a range of enforcement actions if needed. David, have I covered that, or are there other elements that you'd like
to... Just one other point, Mr. Chair and Representative Galizio. Most of the check cashers also have other services they provide, and many of them are licensed with us in other capacities. It would not be unusual for us, if we went in on an examination, to find out if they've got the posting that we required, for instance, in the bill. We're not going to go around from station to station and see if they posted it, but if we're in there, we're certainly going to check and make sure that the compliance is in place.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Lisa, if I could. Yes, thank you for mentioning that. And often payday lending, title lending, money transmitting, sale of money orders, which is not directly regulated, and check cashing all take place in one storefront.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Next, I'd like to have Tom Shockless, I believe.
Chairperson and other members of the committee. My name is Tom Shockless. I'm the president of the Consumer Financial Services Association of Oregon, and I'm also the vice president of Oak Brook Financial Corporation, which owns or controls 41 check cashing stores here in Oregon. We've been in business for almost 24 years. Our company owns the first check cashing store location operate in Oregon, and we employ approximately 150 employees. Many of them are single parents. I appreciate this invitation to testify here at the committee hearing, and I appreciate the work that DCBS has done thus far on the bill. We are anxious to work with them and have already provided them information relative to other states and their fee structures. And we are desirous to help in the process of constructing a bill that meets all the needs of all the stakeholders in the legislation, both the consumers as well as business owners, as well as the state's interest in protecting those consumers. We support the bill with the following recommendations. The proposed bill caps the fee on the cashing of a check or draft issued by the federal government, a state government, or a county or municipal government, or a federal or state agency, or a payroll check at 3% or $5, whichever is greater. Although we're not really aware of an analysis that's actually been done on a fee cap, these other states have institute these fee caps, we would request that there be consideration for some of the different type of payment instruments, as Ms. Streisinger, Director Streisinger, was talking about, because some of those checks have a greater attendant risk than others. In this day and age of color copiers, it's very easy to produce convincing checks, and which is very expensive to do the necessary verification in order to determine whether or not to cash the check. There's also been a gradual decrease in the volume of checks, which has caused profit margins to narrow. an unnecessarily low fee will exacerbate that situation. There's been increased costs, just like banks, which check cashers have to comply with the Bank Secrecy Act, Anti-Money Laundering Act, the U.S. Patriot Act. And there's higher real estate taxes, increased cost of insurance, banking, and money delivery services that we've experienced. Obviously, the stability of the check cashing industry, which serves the needs of many of the unbanked citizens, as Director Streisinger referenced, requires a stable financial reward commensurate with the investment and risk of the operation. It's interesting to note that in the 24 years that we've been in business, we've never raised our fees. I can't think of another service industry that can speak to that, can say the same thing. We would hope that perhaps there'd be a mechanism within the bill that would allow for periodic reviews of those rates to take into account inflation and other increased operating expenses. Under unlicensed check cashing activity, a license is not required if a business does not purport to be a check casher and, quote, from time to time, unquote, and as, quote, as an incident of or independent of a retail sale or services, cashes a payment instrument for a fee, whichever is greater. The recommendation is the threshold should be lowered for activity that does not require a license. Otherwise, what happens is it encourages circumvention of the law by somebody running perhaps a convenience store who decides that if they're doing less than 10% or 5% in this particular area, they don't have to be licensed. Unregulated check cashers are less likely to comply with consumer protection, such as posting fee schedules, providing receipts to customers, etc. And unregulated check cashers are more likely to impair law enforcement efforts to ensure U.S. Patriot Act and BSA and AML compliance, control money laundering, and the rapid expanding forms of financial fraud and identity theft. We also, much as was addressed in the prior bill, would like to see the right of a licensee to take any legal action to protect its business interest against an illegal competitor. Under the current proposal, a licensee has no means available to bring a civil action, private right of action, as we say, to protect its business interest against an illegal competitor. Under licensing procedures, an applicant for a check cashing license must apply by submitting an application in the form prescribed by the regulator. We've made a recommendation that perhaps a certain time should be allocated within 90 days for a license to be either approved or not approved, so business can be conducted, stores can be opened. Under application license fees, the proposal currently is the director sets cost of application, investigation, and annual license fees. Our recommendation would be that there be reasonable caps on application, investigation, and annual license fees, and it should be expressly set inside the within the check cashing law. Currently, under the proposed bill, a licensee may not assign or transfer a license. We would like to see a provision which would incorporate in the bill which would permit transfers of licenses in a manner that preserves the value of licensees' businesses. It's very awkward if you run a business for 20 or 25 years and you're unable to transfer that license to obviously a qualified purchaser, but have the right to transfer that license. Under examination procedures, under the current bill, the records of a check cashing business may be examined for compliance by the regulator. The check casher may be charged for actual cost of examination, which cost will be prescribed by law. We'd just like to make a recommendation that the regulator give reasonable notice prior to an examination date and reasonable limitations imposed upon the cost of the examination. Under penalties, under the current bill, the proposed bill, the director may issue a penalty not to exceed $1,000 per violation per day. We'd recommend that the penalty be lowered per violation and a cap placed on overall penalties assessed. And the reason for that is if you can have a legitimate operator going along doing what they think is correct, and because the auditor doesn't get out there for 7 or 8 or 9 months and discovers an error on their part, they could technically be subject to every incident of that violation over 7 or 8 months with no without intention, just as a unplanned oversight or a mistake being made. I don't know if the committee, Mr. Chairperson, or the committee has had an opportunity to go into a convenience store, but there are also now automated check cashing stores in some of the convenience stores. Consideration should be given to requiring licensure for the automated check cashing machines, and perhaps there should be limitations on their use. And then the final recommendation is hopefully there would be clarification as to the mechanism and procedure to be utilized in implementing a new check cashing law with regard to existing operators that seek to be licensed, some sort of grandfather clause. I've also attached to my testimony some excerpts from a publication published by FISCA, which is the National Association which regulates and governs check cashing operators. It explains who check cashers are, who check cashing customers are, and some of the myths about check cashing. I thank the committee and Mr. Chairperson for providing this opportunity to share testimony, and we look forward to working with DCBS to help continue to provide a bill, again, that meets all the needs of all the stakeholders.
Thank you very much. Do we have questions from the committee? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. Thank you for your testimony. And I'm sorry I didn't do as much homework as Representative Galizio. So I have a question for you about when you talked about the standing issue and how a licensee should have the right to bring a legal action to protect your own business interests against an illegal competitor, is that something that is allowed in other states that have limitations on check cashing?
Yes, it is. But I apologize. I can't cite you the state, but I can get that information for you. Sometimes it's very frustrating when you are licensed operator trying to do the right thing, follow the appropriate laws, and you have somebody who's operating outside the law, and for whatever reason, perhaps the state can't take action. It would be frustrating not to be able to take action to force that issue and seek damages for somebody who obviously is competing with you illegally.
Thank you.
Representative Galizio.
Mr. Shucks, I had a question, and I don't know if this was already mentioned, but probably in other hearings this was. So it says that Oak Brook Financial owns and or controls 41 check cashing payday loan stores in Oregon. And do you know approximately how many check cashing stores there are in the state?
Well, that's an interesting question, Representative Galizio, and we had a discussion with DCS about that because there aren't licensing requirements at this point. The numbers are I would suspicion it's between 150 to 200 locations here in Oregon.
Okay. Follow up,
Representative
Galizio. Is Oak Brook Financial Corporation, is it a public company?
No, sir. We're privately held.
Privately held. So would you care to give us an idea of, I mean, you're citing there are costs to this business, and you cited some of the costs and the potential costs. Would you be able to give us a ballpark about how profitable your company was, let's say, in the last fiscal year?
I would be happy to supply that information. I'm a little uncomfortable at this point because we're involved in different activities, and I don't want to give you inaccurate information, but I will provide that to your office, Representative Galizio.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One small point. One of your proposals was that the person who's going to do an audit give you sufficient notice, and that kind of made my eyebrows knit a little bit, because my opinion is that they should just show up, because what's the point? We want to see if you're conducting your business properly. Giving your time to prepare for it doesn't seem reasonable to me.
In some respects, it's counterintuitive, and I think it takes a paradigm shift. I think with banks, for example, when the bank auditors come in, it's not a surprise audit where they show up with where they're predisposed to believe that something bad is going on. What these audits are, Director Streisinger can speak to this. They're just what they are, is desire to see if you're in full compliance, and they go back over prior months' transactions. So there's nothing that you're going to do if they let you know for efficiency purposes. Say you schedule enough people on site at a given location to deal with customers, provide good customer service, as well as meet the needs of gathering information for the auditor. There's nothing you're really going to be able to do with notice to kind of fix everything or whatever else. That's my reason for doing it. Otherwise, what happens sometimes, you have an auditor show up at a one-person store, and there's just not the time to either meet the needs of the auditor and service the needs of the consumers there who many times come in with a 15-minute break during lunch or whatever, trying to get transactions accomplished, either wiring money, cashing a check, or purchasing money orders.
Thank you for that answer.
Not all.
Any other questions from the committee?
Thank you very much for your testimony. You've posed some interesting questions, which I'm sure our committee will take a look at.
Thank you, sir.
Next, I'd like to call up Angela Martin and Laura Etherton, please. Good afternoon. Please, whichever you want to start, state your name for the record, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thanks for hearing my testimony today. For the record, my name is Angela Martin. I'm here representing Our Oregon and the Economic Fairness Coalition. The coalition includes many of Oregon's leading social service nonprofits, consumer advocates, faith-based organizations, and workers' unions. Every week, we meet and speak with people who have firsthand experience with Oregon's high-cost financial market. One woman who comes to mind is a woman I met in Tigers who explained in great detail the lengthy process she goes through simply to cash her paycheck. Instead of the seamlessly receiving her paycheck through electronic transfer, she takes it to one of the check-cashing stores in her neighborhood where she pays as much as $32 every two weeks to cash her paycheck. Over the course of the year, this adds up to more than $800. When I asked what she would do if she had a few extra $100 in her budget, she starts down a long list of needs. She'd pay down the utility bill that grows during the winter, replace the tires that have gone a little bit bald, or make a special purchase for her daughter of an outfit that she might have had her eye on for school. Oregonians tell us that as much as 7% is sliced from every check they cash. Compared to the virtually cost-free services for people who have checking accounts with banks or credit unions, this is an astonishing premium to pay just to gain access to their own money, their hard-earned paychecks. The stories we hear reflect the current research on the emergence of high-cost financial services. One report by the General Accounting Office found that in 2002, an estimated 22 million households or 56 million adults did not have a bank account. A Federal Reserve survey of consumer finance found that 33% of families headed by persons age 50 or older don't have a checking account. A little bit closer to home, we see the 2006 Hunger Factor survey conducted by Oregon Food Bank found that 53% of emergency food box recipients, again, do not have a checking account. These are families that rely on services within the fringe financial market, the payday lenders, auto title lenders, and check cashing outlets to gain access to cash and credit. While these providers make the services seem very easy, they're selling convenience at a premium price. The service carries a high cost and diminishes the ability for low-income families to accumulate assets and establish financial stability. State, local, and national programs make important investments in the financial well-being of our families. Programs and policies such as the Earned Income Tax Credit, the Working Families Tax Credit, the Food Stamp Program, and minimum wage are just a few of those programs. They are proven policies that add to a family's purchasing power. However, too much of this increased purchasing power is squandered on overpriced financial services. The example I give is how high-cost check cashing strips money from one of our country's largest anti-poverty programs, the Earned Income Tax Credit. Last session, our lawmakers passed an expansion of the Oregon EITC. This is a very important tool helping low-wage working families put more money in their pockets. We see that in 2004, more than 200,000 working Oregon families received an EITC credit for a total of $354 million. And every penny of that money should go into their pockets to help purchase groceries, pay the rent, keep the electricity on. However, too much of that money is going to check cashers instead of the family budgets. As you know, the EITC refund checks come as a tax refund from the state and or the federal government. It's a guaranteed check with no danger of bouncing. Yet fees in Oregon can range to 4%, 6%, reaching as high as 10% to cash all types of checks. At just 6%, cashing that $1,000 EITC refund check will cost the family $60. This is a considerable markup given one of the statistics I read today showing that under the Federal Reserve Automated Clearinghouse, cashing a government check costs about 4 cents. This is no risk for the store owner. It's money in their pocket. But for the check casher in a tight economy, it's money down the drain. We look again at national studies, which show us that over the course of a year, individuals without a checking account who utilize retail check cashing will spend as much as $17,000 on these types of services. By pursuing policies aimed at bringing down these costs, we're putting money for the college education, home ownership, or secure retirement back into the pockets of the most financially vulnerable Oregon families. We certainly commend the leadership of the governor and DCBS on taking leadership on this issue. It's a little over a year ago that we sat down together in a meeting, and I started sharing stories of people I had met throughout Oregon who utilized these types of services and learned the price that they were paying to cash their paychecks, Social Security checks. Hearing that stories, those stories, they took action and drafted 2202, what is before us today. As you learn, that would limit check cashing fees for payroll and government checks at 3% of the face value. Members of the Economic Fairness Coalition would like to take this just one step further with an almost identical proposal, which would limit fees on our payroll and government checks at 2%, and in addition would add a layer of protection by placing a limit on personal checks at 10%. A much higher level to account for that risk, but putting some protection in there nonetheless. We find that half the states cap fees on that check cashers may charge. The lowest rate caps are set by states like Illinois, New Jersey, and New York, all of which set their fees below 2%. Nine states set the rates at or below 2% for at least one category of check. We believe it's time for Oregon to do the same. At this point, I'll end my testimony and invite any questions you may have.
Questions from the committee? I don't see any questions. Thank you for your testimony. It's very interesting. And Laura, would you like to introduce yourself for the record, please?
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Holvey and members of the committee, for the opportunity to testify today here on the topic of check cashing. Again, my name is Laura Etherton, and I'm the consumer advocate with Oregon State Public Interest Research Group, or OSPIRG. Consumers should be able to have access to their own money without paying unreasonably high fees. Currently, that's not the case, as we've heard, for many Oregonians who do not have a traditional bank account and who instead use the services of a check cashing store. These stores are currently unregulated in Oregon and are charging, as we've heard, fees that can reach as high as 10% across the country. Studies have revealed check cashing stores charging as high as 15% or more. Over time, these high check cashing fees drain resources from a consumer's pocketbook, and it's not insignificant. The practices of charging high fees to cash a government-issued check or a payroll check are especially difficult to justify because of the lack of real risk that the check casher is taking in cashing a check that they can be fairly certain will not bounce. These fees should certainly be limited, preferably as low as possible. 2% would be our preference in that area regarding government-issued and payroll checks. Typical fees to cash personal checks are also tend to go on the higher end. This is an area that we would urge this committee to consider, including limits on the fees that consumers can be charged for charging these checks as well. Even though they do put the check casher at a little bit more risk, we believe that excessive rates in this area are a problem and they should be reined in. We commend the governor and the Department of Consumer and Business Services for bringing these important issues forward and wanted to convey our support for regulating these industries and for enacting the lowest possible limits on the fees they charge. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? See none. Thank you very much for your testimony. Next, I'd like to call up John Mullen and Arthur Towers.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Mullen. I'm the legislative advocate with the Oregon Law Center, and the Oregon Law Center works on economic and social justice issues for low-income Oregonians. Basically, my testimony will be very brief today, just to say that we are in support of the concepts in House Bill 2202, and we're pleased that the Department of Consumer and Business Services has brought this issue before you, and we are hopeful that these are among the consumer protections that will be enacted by this legislature. And I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions of the Oregon Law Center?
Go ahead, Arthur.
Chair Holvey and members of the committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to testify today in favor of House Bill 2202. We really applaud the governor, Director Streisinger, and the agency for stepping up on this issue. And we echo the comments and concerns raised by our Oregon Osberg AARP and our other allies. We represent more than 10,000 in-home caregivers and nursing home workers, 6,000 child care providers, and 4,000, those workers are all very low income. Despite our best efforts, so they're still struggling to make ends meet. We also represent 4,000 state and higher ed workers who earn less than the threshold for food stamps for a family of four. And because of the rising cost of living, because of the concerns that we've seen in the area of predatory lending and consumer abuse, the leadership of our local has added to our priority list for this session, in addition to our priorities of affordable quality health care, tax fairness and funding for public services and workers' rights. We also want to emphasize this session economic fairness in our communities. And so, again, we very much support this legislation, are interested in the changes that have been recommended, and really appreciate you putting this towards the top of your agenda as one of the first bills that you hear this session. Thank you very much.
Any questions of the panelists from the committee? Representative Gillian.
Chairman, I wanted to ask a question about the folks that they serve, if that's okay. I don't want to go too far afield, but I'm just interested. I'm sorry, is it Mr. Mullen?
Yes. There?
Regulation, of looking at regulatory solutions to this problem is certainly appropriate. I'm just curious, and I know you don't have time to tell me everything, but what are we doing or what could be done at the other end? Because the goal here is to solve the problem. At the other end, in terms of education, guidance, assistance with the folks that you service, I'd ask both of you that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, my job with the Oregon Law Center began on January 8th, and prior to that, my career was running Clackamas County Social Services, which was an area agency on aging and a community action agency. And so very familiar with working within the community on a variety of these issues. And one of the things that we did with working with our clients was to help to give them information about how to go about getting a bank account. And in particular, we had a very positive working relationship with the credit union just down the block from us, and so we would often engage clients in a discussion about how they might look at the issues about their finances in a little bit of a different way.
Go ahead.
Yeah, if you'd like to respond to that.
Sure.
But could you restate your name for the record? I'm not sure our administrator caught that.
Absolutely. My name is Arthur Towers. I'm the political director for Service Employees Union Local 503. And Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, in our case, one thing that we've been working to do with our in-home caregivers and with our child care providers is negotiate with the state to allow for the electronic payment system, you know, so that people can have the automatic deposit of their paychecks and of the payments they receive from the state. We think that's a step in the right direction. But at the same time, many of our members' neighbors don't have that luxury. And so, again, it's a problem for our members, but a problem in our members' communities as well.
Any other questions from the committee? Thank you very much for your testimony this afternoon. Appreciate it. And for the record, I also received written testimony from ARC, Director of Government Relations Rick Bennett, who also supports House Bill 2202 and would recommend that the cashing fees be $4 or 2%, whichever is greater, and would also recommend a limit for check cashing fees of $5 or 10%, whichever is greater of face value of all other checks. And with that, I would like to know if there's anybody else in the audience who would like to provide further testimony on House Bill 2202. Representative Galizio.
Mr. Chair, I don't want to testify, but I just wanted to state one thing for the record. After listening to testimony, the reality is that, you know, they're serving a market. You know, this industry is obviously serving a market that exists. And they employ Oregonians, some of whom, I don't know, perhaps even use the service. And other financial institutions are obviously not serving this market, which is... So I just wanted to express my appreciation. I'm glad Mr. Shockless took the time to come out today to testify, and I hope that he will and others in the industry will continue to work with DCBS so there is, you know, reasonable regulation that gets at some of the problems that exist at the same time, you know, allows an industry that exists and is employing people to continue in Oregon. So just wanted to get that for the record.
Thank you, Representative. Anybody else want to put something on the record? Thank you very much. And with that, I'd like to close the public hearing on House Bill 2202. And I would like to also adjourn this committee. Thank you.